Bruce Lipton is an internationally recognized authority in bridging science and spirit. A biologist by training, he taught cell biology at the University of Wisconsin's School of Medicine and later performed pioneering studies at Stanford University's School of Medicine. His breakthrough studies on the cell membrane presage the new science of epigenetics and have made him a leading voice of the new biology. Well, welcome, Bruce.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Great opportunity to talk about new biology. Been a biologist for years and years and years, mm-hmm. and though I'm not connected with academia anymore, conventional academia, I certainly continue my pursuits and my studies because the world's unfolding in a very interesting way these days. And,
oh, yes.
And for me, it's fun because the new biology that's coming out right now is the science that I started talking about in 1985. So it's almost 20 years ago, mm-hmm. I saw where we were going, and now we're in that direction, and it's real exciting because when people start to really realize the consequence of this new biology, it's going to change civilization, and I'm so excited about that.
Well, it's a puzzling thing. I mean, so your new book is called The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracle. How did you come to that from being a biologist?
Well, the idea for me about it is, to take a step back, was I got mm-hmm. into biology because I was seeking science as opposed to seeking spirit. When I was young, mm-hmm. What happened was that the people that I was associated with in regard to spiritual beliefs and spiritual teachings, when I started to see these people, I started to realize what they were talking about and the way they were living were not one and the same. And at some point, I think it was a bit of a hypocrisy. And I thought, this spiritual stuff didn't seem to ride, but science hit me because science was sort of like, well, if you find a scientific fact in this country, it's the same scientific fact in any other country.
Right,
And so I was looking for universal truth. And so I was not going into spirituality. And the biggest surprise to me, as was revealed in the book, was that my departure and going farthest away from spirit, going in deep into science, I ended up becoming spiritual. So it was like, oh my God, it was like a snake going on its own tail. The farther away I ran, the it drove me right into spirituality. Mm-hmm. But I'm really excited by it because it's a spirituality that has a scientific foundation to it, and it's not a spirituality with like a long religious history and a lot of dogma to it. It's really like, science, spirit, one and the same.
But you came to it through cell biology.
Well, yeah, and this was a big surprise to me. As I said, I got into trying to understand the nature of cells, and this was like an interest that I first acquired when I was in second grade.
And all living beings have cells.
Well,
right?
More than that, I think the big issue is that most people do not realize this simple fact, and that is, we look at ourselves in the mirror, and so you look in the mirror, you see Anthony, I look in the mirror, I see Bruce, and we think of ourselves as these single entities walking around. Mm-hmm. It's really a gross misperception in this regard that while we think of ourselves as singular entities, the truth is we're made out of a community of upwards of, let's say, 50 trillion cells. And what's the point? The cells are the living entities. The cells are the things that are alive. I am a community of cells. When mm-hmm. I say mm-hmm. I am speaking for 50 trillion cells.
Well, the I that you speak with is the voice of those 50 trillion.
Absolutely it is. It's sort of like a government, like a leadership of this community. Well, every cell is innately intelligent. And this is the work that I got involved with real early in my graduate studies. I was cloning stem cells. And what's interesting is, while people talk about stem cells today as this like leading edge new kind of topic, what I was working on stem cells and cloning them back in the late 1960s. And my research that finally was published by the mid 70s, I was publishing research that revealed that these cells are extremely intelligent beings, and that you can remove them from a body, put them in an alien petri dish, so to speak, and they'll mm-hmm. have their own life. They manage everything they need to do to stay alive. They can thrive, they can reproduce, they can form the things they were going to form in the body. And so basically what it says is every cell is an intelligent being. But what's interesting is when cells come together in a community, the nature of a community is that all members of a community are like on some, you know, similar plan or guide or some direction that unites a community together. Mm-hmm. Well, when a member is in a community, that a member is not really allowed to do whatever they want to do. They really have to conform to the community. Because if a person is in a community and says, well, I, you know, I forget, you know, whatever the group wants to do, this is what I want to do, then mm-hmm. at that moment, you're really starting to break the community up, because if you lose your sense of purpose or direction, if individuals in the community start going in their own directions at some place, then the mission of that community seems to be lost in the process. Why is this relevant? Is because, yes, I'm made out of 50 trillion cells. Yes, every cell is intelligent. But when they're in the community of the body, there's an agreement that that they will follow a central voice, that central voice, the mm-hmm. the mind, so to speak, in what we're talking about.
And that's an evolutionary process?
That's an evolutionary process to make coherency within the group. So that means,
you talk about specialization, you know, because the primitive cells have to do a lot of functions, but in order to become more efficient, then the tasks of each cell is delegated to the specialists.
The exact story that is a replica of what's going on in the human body is that every cell is like an individual human in human society. Every cell has every function that a human has. In other words, you can look at a human body and say, well, let me look at the textbook of physiology of humans. Oh, they have a reproductive, respiratory, digestive, excretory, mm-hmm. nervous system, immune system. Every one of those systems already exists in every cell. We as collective humans cannot do anything that a cell can do. We're made out of cells. So the interesting thing is, then if I would shrink you down the size of a cell, put you inside my cellular community, you would see a community of individuals just like we see on the streets today. People having jobs and specializations of what they do to contribute to the survival of the community. And this is what the cells have. So a muscle cell, a liver cell, a stomach cell. Well, as individual cells, they all have all the same functions that a human has. Every cell has to breathe and eat and, you know, do all the functions of a cell, so like a human. Mm-hmm. So every cell has all the human functions, but then when they specialize, they take one of the functions and elaborate on it so that, well, every cell has muscle so it can move around. A muscle cell is a cell that takes that muscle character and enhances it greatly so that its primary function is acting as muscle. A stomach cell has to do digestion just like any other cell, but takes the function of digestion and blows it up as its major life function, let's say. So what are we looking at? We're looking at a community, 50 trillion intelligent individuals, each of them capable of surviving alone, having all the systems to maintain life, and yet cooperating in a community by taking on jobs and their exchanges, so that it's actually, there's an energy exchange in the system, just as we have a money exchange in our system, and there are work
sounds
relations.
Sounds very self-similar in a chaos theory way.
Well, this is exciting, yeah.
Human culture.
Well, this is what the character of the work ultimately revealed, that that our biology is designed on a fractal geometry, and that nature is on a fractal geometry. And the relevance about that says is that the images repeat themselves over and over again. So when you look at a cell, you're actually looking at a miniature human in a sense of functional capacity. And then when you look at a human, well, you're looking at a community of cells that collectively act as one giant cell, and that's us. And then when you look at humanity, you're looking at a multicellular organisms where we are the cells doing the same functions that the cells in our body are doing. And in a sense, the fractal character of it really underscores mm-hmm. that old saying, as is above, as is below.
Right.
And all of a sudden it says, well, that's not just a saying, that's a basis of geometry at this point. Mm-hmm. And why is it relevant? Is because it has great instructional value.
Well, there's insights that you have, I'm sure, from having studied the cells and understood, and I want to come to perhaps, maybe this is the appropriate time, about how the nucleus of the cell functions, how, you know, you, in your book, you talk about the marvel that you discovered that the membrane of the cell was the brain of the cell.
Yeah, well, and this is real exciting because in that time when I was doing my research, I was teaching medical school and I was teaching mm-hmm. basic science. So I was teaching medical students the foundation of life and the conventional story that genes control life. And that, this is still being taught today at this very moment in schools all over the place, that genes are the controlling factor.
People don't know how they work.
They know, and the interesting thing is that people at the leading edge of science know how they work, and people in the public have a completely different perspective, and they're so divergent that this is the big failure of our system. This is why I'm trying to say that the new biology will change civilization, because our current perception of biology and who we are, our current perception of ourselves, is that we are, from the view of science, biochemical robotic automatons that are controlled genes.
That's the model of the clock that Newton came up with.
Exactly, and they still use that same model, so that if something's wrong with your clock, then they're going to say, well, look, let me give you some new gears, which are called drugs, and their effort is to adjust everything in biology. Is if there's a defect in the behavior or the emotions or the physiology, it's not attributed to anything other than a defect in the physical mechanism. So this is why when now you look at this drug market, and it's a scary situation, and it's one of the most destructive corporations in our civilization today for this reason, is that they are selling drugs to the extent that they're taking normal people and making drug addicts out of them by taking normal life circumstances and saying that's a medical condition. And as soon as they say it's a medical condition, then all of a sudden we have drugs. So sure. Just in the last week, I saw several of them. One of them was a drug for compulsive shoppers.
Oh, no.
Yes, they say, oh, yeah, because because when shopping satisfies some urge, and so they have this drug that will dim the urge so that in other words, they look at compulsive shopping as a biochemical defect, and that a drug will stem that urge. And then, on top of that one, there's another one. I think it was called motivational deficiency syndrome, meaning lazy people may not be lazy, but they have a medical condition called motivation deficiency, I think, syndrome.
Are these all new entries in the DSM-4?
Well, the drug companies are making drugs. One of the drug they're making, it was funny because I read the article on this, and the name of the drug for this motivational disorder is called Strivor. And it was interesting because it said the side effect is that it could make you very aggressive.
Oh, no.
So it's like, oh, great. You know, it's like, and the point about it is this is the medicalization of everyday life events.
Right.
And that's basically because these people who write about this now a lot about, you know, selling sickness, reveal that we've run out of the major diseases to make drugs for. And so what they're doing is creating new disease entities and selling new drugs.
Oh, okay.
And so the effort about that is, you know, something like I saw on TV called restless leg syndrome.
And I saw that.
And at first when I saw it, I thought, this is a joke, isn't it? And then it's like, no, these are very serious. It's another drug that if you can't seem to rest, you know, get your, you know, if you feel like you got to move, then you need a drug to stop moving. It's like, So the issue about this is what is the consequence of this? We're buying a belief system of who we are from an organization that makes money by selling pieces and parts to fix who we are according to the model.
Yeah.
And the problem is, well, that model is the one that says you're a genetic automaton, that genes control who you are. And that's the belief. That's why we read in the paper every day. They're looking for a gene that controls this and a gene that controls that, with the emphasis that when they figure out these genes, then all of our problems are going to be resolved, because whatever your problem is, I got a gene for you, kind of thing.
Have I got a gene for you?
I start to be very wary of people selling me things like that. So, but the thing was, I was doing research on these stem cells. And based on some interesting research that was over 100 years ago, there were some original studies on the early studies on experimental embryology. One of the things they were doing way back then was removing the nucleus from a marine organism, like a sea urchin or a starfish, remove the nucleus from their eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, they found that the egg would actually start to become activated in the absence of the nucleus, and that the cell would divide, maybe it'd form up to 60 cells, like an embryo with 60 cells. None of the cells
through mitosis.
Through all the mitosis, none of the cells had genes. Basically, what it says was the program for dividing, creating the embryo didn't require the genes of the nucleus at all, because it was already pre-programmed, and that these things would go without genes. And then other studies revealed that you could remove the nuclei from certain cells, and that these things would live maybe 2 months or more without any genes. Now, when I'm saying live, that didn't mean they were just sitting there. Mm-hmm. They were moving around. They were eating, digesting their food,
doing breathing. What they did.
They did everything. They communicated with other cells, and they did everything. So basically, I said, wait, you have to stop and say something. You have to say, wait, if genes are supposedly controlling the cell, and then you have cells with no genes in them, and these cells survive with an integrated functional behavior for up to 2 months without any genes, there's a point where you actually have to say, genes are not controlling the life of that cell, because whatever it is, the control's still there and the genes aren't there. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I did the same kind of work with my clone stem cells. I removed the nucleus or destroyed the DNA in the nucleus, and the cells still go on behaving and could change their behavior when I altered the environment, which meant that they were able to do all this activity without the presence of genes. Mm-hmm. So what my research was focused on was, well, if genes are not controlling the cell, which apparently they're not, what is controlling the cell? And that research that led me to the structure called the cell membrane, which is the skin of the cell.
Right.
And the relevance about that is that the cell membrane as an organelle is the only organelle that is common to every living cell on this planet. While all the other kinds of organelles are variable depending on the cells, every cell must have a cell membrane.
Yes, yes.
So it's the most primitive organelle to have evolved and the one that is found, you know, throughout every living organism. So what's relevant about it is it has a lot of function to it. But biology, and when I was involved with it and being a structural biologist doing a lot of electron microscopy and biochemistry, there's a very direct correlation between structure and function. And so that this is what the nature of biology is. Well, if you look at the structure, you'll get some idea of the function, or if you're looking at the function and then you can identify a structure, they connect with each other. The cell membrane had trouble with that correlation, because the cell membrane is so thin a structure that you can't even see it with a regular microscope. You can only see it with an electron microscope.
Well, it's only a few microns thick.
Yeah, and it's actually less than, it's not even a micron thick, really. So the issue about it is it's not visible. And until the development of the electron microscope in the late 40s, they didn't even know that cell membranes A existed or that it was a character of every living cell. So the cell membrane, when it was first identified in the electron microscope, then they looked at this little tiny vanishingly thin layer, and they said, well, what function could that be, you know, because you look at the structure and it doesn't seem to imply any function to it except that it's a skin. And it must be permeable.
An integument, yes.
Yeah, it's a skin, and it must be permeable because food gets in and waste gets out, so it must be able to go through the skin. So the original story of what the cell membrane was like a piece of saran wrap that held all the contents inside and had little pores in it, so it allowed things in and out.
Right.
And when I started working on, I started to realize as I was tracing back the control that I'm going back to the cell membrane, and I started to look at this molecular structure of the cell membrane, and I started to reveal that it had an amazingly beautiful structure. It's a crystalline structure. It's actually
a liquid
crystal.
That's what you were saying.
Crystal.
It's a phospholipid molecule, right?
Yeah, these molecules line up just like soldiers on a parade. And when you see molecules in high order like that, it's an indication of a crystal structure.
Right.
So the membrane is a crystalline structure. And in fact, when I started to, it was back in 1985, and I've been now working on the fact that the membrane was the control mechanism for about 5 or 6 years, looking at it upside down, left and right, trying to get some grasp for, give me some insight into this mechanism.
The three-dimensionality of it,
And at that point, it was in 1985 that I actually wrote down a definition of the membrane in a different fashion than I had done heretofore. And I wrote down this description. So I'm sitting there in 1985, and I write down the cell membrane is a liquid crystal semiconductor with gates and channels. And I say that
I read that in your book, and I just fell on the floor.
It was a shock, because in 1985, I said, you know, I've heard that phrase, but back in 1985, I wasn't familiar with where I actually read it, because it wasn't biology. And then all of a sudden, that led me, of course, to the fact that I just bought my first Macintosh, and I bought a book from Radio Shack, Understanding Your Microprocessor, and I looked in there, and I said, oh my God, that's where I read it, and I read in that definition, liquid crystal semiconductor with gates and channels is the same definition as a computer chip.
Yes, yes.
And then I looked at it, and for the first millisecond or two, I was like, funny, you know, ha, that's so, isn't that a coincidence that the cell membrane, a computer chip, has the very same definition? But then all of a sudden I looked at it with real seriousness. I went, oh my God, it's not a coincidence. It's molecular architecture and its molecular function is indistinguishable from a computer chip.
That's bizarre.
And what happened is I realized, oh my God, the cell membrane is an information processor, a chip, and the nucleus and the genes that we said were controlling the cell turn out to be a hard drive. And the genes are programs. And what's interesting, as I was then at that moment typing this into my computer as it was being somewhat downloaded into my mind, I realized the cell is a programmable chip. And this is what my clone stem cells revealed, that I could take the cell and genetically identical cells, split them up into three groups, same cells, genetically identical, put one in petri dish A with environment A with conditions that are special for that, take another group of the same cells, put them in a petri dish B with a different environment, and a third set, the same cells, in another petri dish with another set of conditions. And guess what? In petri dish A, the cells form muscle. In petri dish B, they form bone. In petri dish C, they form fat. And what was relevant about this was, wait, I'm teaching that genes control life. I have genetically identical cells, but one group forms muscle, another bone, another fat. But what made the difference? And the answer was, well, first of all, they were genetically identical, so that wasn't the issue. It was the environment. And that's when I realized the conditions of the environment were feeding back into the cell. The cell was responding to what it sees, and it pulls out a program from its nucleus to match the requirements of the environment. So it says that every living cell adjusts its genes to match the needs that are demanded of it to stay alive in the environment.
This is amazing.
And what was so unreal about it was, after teaching all these years of genes control biology, recognizing, A, I didn't even need the genes in there because you could remove the genes, but still the cell membrane was reading the environmental information and adjusting the biology to meet the needs. So the cell was being driven by the environment. And when I even did experiments where I removed the receptors, the antennas on the surface of the cell that read that environment, so the cell couldn't respond to the environment, the cells round up and do nothing. They're comatose. They just sit there and they'll wait there until these antennas are replaced on the surface. And then once they visualize the environment, then they engage in behavior again.
But now if the cell nucleus is gone, they can't respond either, right?
Well, this is where, because when the cell nucleus is gone, it provides the blueprints to make the antennas. See, so what's the difference is the genes are blueprints to make parts. Yeah. But what the parts do, when the parts are used, which parts are needed, has nothing to do with the genes. And that's where we went awry, because we said, well, the genes make the decision to turn on and turn off, and it turns out, no, the genes are turned on by the environmental signals. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, as I'm typing on my computer, entering this information, I realize, well, my computer is like a cell, the keyboard are the receptors,
yes.
I'm the environment, I'm typing information in, I'm getting a feedback on the screen, and so the computer is giving me a readout of the data that I'm putting in. And it's interesting because then you think about, well, what's medicine? You take a patient, you look at them, you get a readout of their physical characters. And what's the point about that? It's like, well, the readout of the physical character is a reflection of the data that went into them. And so
much more so than the genes.
That's the big difference. That's the big difference, is that the genes are only potentials, and that their potentials are only controlled by our response to the environment. And that's why, and it's interesting because with all this, this is like now, like 1985, when I finally came to this, and I started doing this culturing stuff by about 1968. I was culturing these cells, and
I went back to my
very first day, where I was being taught cloning cells by my mentor, Dr. Erwin Konigsberg, who was brilliant. He was the man who developed the cloning process for stem cells, okay? So he was showing me on my very first day, I was running through the procedure to make the cultures, and I got to the last step. I inoculate the petri dish with these cells, and I'm about to stick the cells dishes into the incubator, and he gives me one caveat, and he goes like this. He said, remember, Bruce, when you come in tomorrow and you look at the cells, if the cells don't look right, before you mess with the cells, check the environmental conditions. And I didn't realize it till 20 some years later that was the most profound piece of information, because it said,
yeah,
the cells are only giving me a readout of the environment. They are a physical reflection of what's going on. So point, I take my petri dish with cells, put it into an environment that's healthy, give it all the nutrients and everything that's right. The cells thrive, they grow, they proliferate, they develop into what they're supposed to do. Or take that same dish, move it into a less than healthy environment.
Stress it somehow.
Stress it.
Yeah.
As soon as you start to stress it, the cells will start to get sick. They'll even start to die. But the interesting thing is, you remove that dish from that stressful environment, return it back to a good environment, and immediately they start to recover their health and become normal again. What's the point? The simplest point, we are skin-covered petri dishes with 50 trillion cells in our cultures. We walk into this environment, and if it's really good, our cells grow and our cells thrive. If we go from this environment to a less than healthy environment, our cells will actually become a physical complement to that particular environment. Get out of that environment and health will come back again.
Incredible.
And yet the issue is interesting, because medicine is following a protocol that it wasn't listening to Irv's original advice. So when a patient comes in, they don't say, well, tell me about your environment.
Right.
They say, well, let's see what's wrong with you.
What's the matter with the clock?
And so they want to look inside at the parts, and the parts are okay. They're not working right. But then we say, well, then the parts aren't working right because there's something wrong with the parts. And the fact is, no. The parts are doing exactly what they would do if you put them in this environment that is not supportive. So it really comes down to the understanding that almost all of the illnesses we express on this planet are stressors related to the environments and not physical disabilities as we suggested they are.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue about that, it doesn't mean that some people don't have physical problems when they came onto this planet. Meaning, if I have genetic defects and I come in and I start making my parts using these gene blueprints and they're defective, of course now some of my parts are going to be defective, and in that case then it's going to interfere with the process that these parts are involved with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but here's the critical point. Only a very small percentage of people on this entire planet can actually use that as a legitimate excuse as to why they are not well. Smaller than 5%,
yep.
Maybe even closer to 2%.
Right.
What's the relevance? Okay, well, let's say 95% of the people, if they get sick on this planet, why did they get sick? And the first thing is, well, if you look at the way we treat them, is because their physical mechanism broke down. And it turns
out...
But
it's localized to the patient rather than the environment.
It's to the patient's response to the environment.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden it's like, so what are we trying to do? Well, we're trying to fix the patient. What we should do is fix their response to the environment, how they respond to the environment. And this is where the separation comes, the jump comes between, well, understanding the nature of cells and understanding the nature of humans. Okay. Interesting, because we talked about the fractal character of it.
Yes.
And their self-similar images. You know, the idea that the skin of the cell is the brain of the cell is totally 100% in agreement with the reality that in the human embryo, after the egg is fertilized, it forms a big ball of cells called the blastula. And the next layer of embryo development, this ball of cell forms three concentric layers, an outer layer, a middle layer, and an inner layer. The outer layer is called the ectoderm, the middle one mesoderm, and the inner one endoderm.
Mm-hmm.
These three layers, each layer gives rise to very specific organs and tissues. So it's interesting, the outer layer of the embryo called the ectoderm only gives rise to two structures in the human. Skin and the central nervous system. So all of a sudden it says...
Really?
Yeah, so it's like, okay, what a coincidence! The brain of the cell is from the skin, and the brain of the human is derived from the skin, so we have a parallel understanding. But here's the difference, though. Cells have very limited capacity of reading their environment. Is there glucose out there? Is there calcium out there? Is there estrogen? Is there histamine? That's what it sees. But when you live in a community of 50 trillion cells, then you have an organized group of cells whose function it is to read the complexities of the environment, interpret those complexities, and then send that information to the other 50 trillion cells. Well, the interesting thing is, the cells that are reading the environment are the ones derived from the skin, the brain. And what do? They interpret the environment, and there's direct readouts. Is it cold out? You walk outside. Is it cold out? You'll read it on your skin. Mm-hmm. The receptors are on your skin, just like on the skin of the cell. Read cold. The feedback goes into the body and says, cold out. It's reflexive. It will cause your temperature to raise and keep your temperature at, you know, 98.6. In contrast, you walk outside and it's hot out. The body reads the temperature of hot. It goes inside, adjusts the physiology so you perspire and cool off. The reality is this, well, what controls your temperature? And the answer is it's not genetics, it's the environment controls that, okay? So basically, so all the physiology is responding to the environment at what's going on. But here comes now the catch. Well, the reading of hot and cold, that's a direct readout. But when I go outside and I look and say, is there Al-Qaeda outside? Well, right, then, you know, now all of a sudden this is an interpretation.
Yes.
Well, then all of a sudden I have to interpret what I see, and then I base it on my experiences and my learning. And if I have mislearning or, you know, misunderstandings during my education, then I will read the environment with a misinterpretation between the environment, the misinterpretation in the brain, and then it's going to send the signal to the cells. And so if I have a misinterpretation of the environment, then I adjust my biology out of order to, it's no longer balancing the environment. I'll give you a great example. An anorexic. An outside person looks at the anorexic and looks at this person skinny as a rail near death. But the anorexic looks in the mirror. So they're looking at a reflection of themselves. So they're getting an outside piece of information, but there's a distortion in the brain that makes their mirror image like a funhouse mirror. They get swollen up.
Yep. And it's all in their perception.
And so their perception is going to lead their biology to reduce their size. And so a misperception will result in their death. It's as clear as that. Yeah, but what about the misperception of fear? What about the misperception that this world is a place of struggle so that I adjust my life to live in struggle?
Social Darwinism.
What if it wasn't in struggle, but I thought it was?
Through the agency of internet and TV and radio.
And news and the people who sell me the story. Is there really a bird flu out there, or am I going to make it up? And the answer is, I'll tell you what. Mm-hmm. Whether there is one out there or whether you make it up, you will not know the difference by looking at the response of the body because it'll be the same. Why?
And that's been shown in hypnosis too, by
exactly,
the way.
But this is what it's all about. And it's interesting because the nature of our perceptions changing our biology, since you got into psychology as a study, then you understand the concept of multiple personalities.
Absolutely.
And that from one personality to the other, it's not that they just change personalities, but as they switch from one to the other, they also change physiological correlations that are specific with one personality and not with the other. They even have different EEGs, which are virtually fingerprints.
Yep.
And that they could have different eye color in one personality to the other personality. Switch eye color when they switch personality. Or they could have an allergic response in personality A and a minute later switch into personality B and whatever that allergen was has no effect on them whatsoever. And then switch them back to personality A and within that minute you show them the same allergen and they'll have an anaphylactic reaction. It's like, wait a minute.
But they're reading different.
So the perception is between the real world and the cells, our perception. Mm-hmm. And therefore, our perception reads the data and adjusts the biology. If the perception is off, then reading the data is going to lead to the wrong response, and that throws our biology off. And the illnesses that we have are not organic illnesses as much as they are of running the biology inappropriately, you know, in regard to the circumstances that exist at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we very powerfully control this. And it's interesting because we talked about multiple personality and that's a disorder. But look, here I'll give you a positive example.
Well, everybody has a multiple personality.
Well, that's true.
Really?
I realize part of me does this
and part of me wants to do that and part of me wants to do that.
And if you could coordinate them and get them to, you know, be on the same page, then it's a lot more fun because then they're not competing with each other.
And it's a collaborative effort in a way that the cells are in the body.
Absolutely. I mean, because I personally experienced that in my own dysfunctions when I was younger.
Sure.
You know, when I started to get into this new biology, it started to become apparent that my God, when I'm in this personality, my whole physiology is in this level of action.
Right, right.
And when I switch to this other personality, it's a completely different level of physiology.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, wow, I'm really switching my senses
and
everything. Yeah. But actors are an example of people who can positively do this.
Yes.
They get into a character. So that's a personality. They get in character, and then their biology will change to match the character. So some people, like Renell Zellweger or Nick Nolte, can gain 40 pounds to do a role while they're in character, and when they switch back to their own personality again, the 40 pounds comes off. And the reality is, my God, they're adjusting their biology to the way they see the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And why this is important is the issues that we face today, the current conventional pharmaceutically run medical industry has us with a perception that we are victims of our chemistry and that they are our rescuers because they sell chemistry to fix the problem. And the interesting part about it is that's a belief system. And
right,
if you buy
into it,
it will become real.
Yep.
And the issue about that is, yeah, but you know, there's a far better belief system. If you really know who you are and it runs by belief, you can be an actor and make yourself anything you really want. If you become a good actor, you can change your biology to make it what you want. And why that's relevant.
That's really powerful, but that's, they don't, the powers in, that be don't want that to get out.
Absolutely not. That's why it's interesting. The stuff I'm talking about, I already knew by 1980s. By 1990, it was already textbook information. I'll give you a quote right out of a textbook, out of a paper, scientific paper. It goes like this. It's in the paper, it was about genetic control mechanisms and metaphors. And it was actually saying, we bought the idea of genes control life, but in 1990, it was clearly understood at that time, and this is a sentence that it says, when a gene product is needed, which is a protein, genes make proteins.
Yes.
When a gene product is needed, a signal from its environment, not an emergent property of the gene itself, activates expression of the gene. What was the point? In 1990, it was in the leading edge research that genes are not self-actualizing, that genes cannot turn themselves on and off. That's a belief system which is totally scientifically incorrect. That in 1990 was established that a signal from the environment turns the genes on and off.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that relevant? Is because we're still teaching today and the mass media is still presenting the public with a belief system that they're victims of their genes. When the fact is...
Well, and victims of a lot else.
Well, yeah, victims of anything in a world where belief turns out to be the, you know, the controlling factor. And it's real surprising because as I started off, I got into science to get away from that whole spiritual, religious kind of stuff. And when I started to fully understand how this membrane processor works, the information processor, and I started to realize it was control from the outside environment, okay? It led to that understanding of how cells adjust their biology through perception. Well, some of our perceptions are accurate and a lot of our perceptions are not. But if I say collectively we're driven by perceptions, that's a truth. But then it hits more to home if I say we're driven by beliefs, which are the perceptions that we hold to be true, whether they are true or not.
And how we ever came to hold those.
Well, right. And that becomes the critical question. But why this is interesting, because when I came full circle, I realized, my goodness, well, here's this guy, Jesus, who I wasn't trained with in any way, a sense of the word. And yet, what did he say? You could renew your life with your belief. He said that. When he healed somebody, he didn't say, I'm just going to heal you. He asked them, do you believe you can be healed?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what was the relevance? He knew he wasn't healing them. He was
asking
them if their belief was ready for them to be healed.
Yep.
And what was the issue? And then, you know, that one statement, which I always love because it's sort of, it's like for me as an outsider, it's like written in the literature, says, look, you know, Jesus essentially says to his followers, is look, all those things that you see me do, all those miracles, you know, it says you can do them better, probably better than I can, but you don't believe you can.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I realize, as far as I ran away the other direction, I come back and say, well, this guy was right. He absolutely was right. Belief does it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the question is, well, if he said that a couple of thousand years ago, that we could do all the miracles that he could do, well, then why, where are those miracles? You know, where, how come we're not seeing them? We actually do call them miracles when somebody does something like heal themselves from a terminal
spontaneous
remission. Yep. And yet, now that I see that, it's like, well, that's, you might call it a miracle, but to me, oh, there's a scientific mechanism exactly how that happened. What that person did was change their perception of life, and it caused the cells, which are programmable chips, to, as soon as they change the perception, perception being the key, you know, driving the keys, the perception's just, you know, activating the keyboard. As soon as you change the perception, you reprogram the cell. So a spontaneous remission is pretty spontaneous. But that's why multiple personality alterations also occur in a minute or so. They, boom, they're this person, and a minute later, they're a different person with different physiology. Mm-hmm. And how fast can that happen? The answer is, well, how fast can you type? and basically...
How fast can you enter the beta?
That's exactly what it's all about.
Now, I wanted to also... You said you had a real revolution in consciousness when you were studying the cells, and you read, and you say in your book, and I went out and bought one, The Cosmic Code by Heinz Pagels.
Yeah.
What contribution did your awareness of quantum reality, as we now understand it, have on your understanding of biology?
Well, it completely said that I was coming, my earlier interpretations of how biology worked were not scientifically founded at all in this regard. As I started to read into physics, I got, first of all, this very basic understanding of physics. Physics means mechanics, and that's why the words are interchangeable. Quantum physics, quantum mechanics. Newtonian physics, Newtonian mechanics. Mechanics means mechanisms, how things occur. Physics is the foundational science of all of our science, because all other sciences are built on the principles of physics. So that if you looked at science as a multi-tiered structure, the bottom floor would be physics, and then chemistry would be the next floor, which is the actions of atoms and in regard to the mechanics. And then biology would be the third floor, because it's a specialized form of biochemistry. And then the fourth tier would be psychology. And what's relevant about this is that each higher science is predicated on the science below it.
Yep.
Okay, so here, so we start the picture. Where am I? I'm in a science building in the biology medical world that is basing its science on Newtonian physics, the bottom floor. The Newtonian physics floor says that it's a mechanical material universe. Don't worry about invisible energy. It's not relevant. There's nothing there, and it doesn't interact with matter. So when you come to the concept of a mind-body duality, mind being energy, body being matter, conventional physics, Newtonian physics, now conventional allopathic medicine says the body is made out of matter, the mind is energy, but energy and matter don't interact, so ignore the role of the mind, focus on the body. It's just mechanical. And so I am trained in Newtonian physics. All of my colleagues are trained in Newtonian physics. There was not one of my colleagues that read quantum mechanics that really understood it. Well, the relevance was when I left the university and I started to pick up this book by The Cosmic Code and started to read it, I said, oh my God, these are mechanisms about how the universe operates that I was completely unaware of in understanding the science that I was doing, the fundamental science. And the relevance about it revealed, especially because they wanted to restrict quantum physics to the atomic and the molecular level, saying that's where it applies, although we know that to be false. The interesting thing was, but that's the level I was working on in biology. I was working
the
on
molecular
the molecules
level.
And the atoms.
Yeah.
And so the reality is, here I am trying to interpret my results using a Newtonian mechanism filter, saying let's focus on the physical things and don't pay any attention to the other stuff. And all of a sudden I'm reading this new physics, which is now 75, 80 years old. Okay, I'm reading this physics that says energy is everything. That the invisible and what appears to be material are both energy. There is nothing but energy. And that all energy must be considered in understanding the mechanisms of the world that we live in.
And we also are, the universe is a unity. Bell's theorem?
Yeah, well, it's basically because, matter, I can separate. If I have a handful of marbles,
right,
I can take one marble out and talk about it separate from the rest of the handful of marbles. So that's a concept of reductionism, that you can take this thing apart and study individual pieces out of the whole and then try to put them back together again, make sense out of it. When you get to quantum mechanics, it says, well, I'm holding a handful of energy. Can you pull out an energy? And the answer is no, they're all entangled. I can't separate one energy from the other.
Right.
What was the point? He says, If you want to understand the universe and how it works, then you can't really get a full understanding through reductionism, because everything is entangled. All the energies are immersed with each other.
You have to come to it through a holism.
Holism. Well, here I am in a field that's studying material mechanical pieces in a reductionistic fashion, and then reading the mechanism of the universe that says, well, there is no such thing as matter and everything is holism. It's like, right away, this is a problem, you know, because it's like, oh
how
my God.
How did you reconcile that?
Because what I had to do was come back and say, well, let's go back in and put it, what are the roles of energy? How does energy interact? And that's when I started to get into the concepts of vibrational frequencies, and then where you can have interferences of energy, like ripples on a pond coming together. And sometimes the ripples come together and they cancel each other out. And sometimes the ripples come together and they increase the strength of the ripples. Since everything is a ripple, be it a physical chemical, meaning an energy wave, a ripple, even a physical chemical, even though we perceive it, it might be a solid, it's focused energy waves, and so that energies in the field interact with the particles, and then you have to realize, oh my goodness, then everything is tied together, as the quantum physicist said, mm-hmm. and that makes the issue. Then you go back to the patient who is trained, who's in an office with a doctor who's trained in Newtonian reductionism.
Oh, right.
So the patient's sitting in the chair, and the doctor's looking at the patient and saying, so what's wrong with you? Trying to figure out what's wrong with this person under their skin, when what's wrong with that person is probably a reflection of what's going on in their environment. And so it's like all of a sudden you realize, well, you're not going to get the answer. So yes, something is off under the skin, and you're going to try to adjust that. And the problem is, it wasn't really off. It was coherent in regard to what the response was to what the organism saw in the environment.
So there's a feedback. If you understand what's going on with the client or the patient, you can understand quite a bit more about what's going on in their environment. And invite them to change that.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting because oncologists who have been in the field long enough know that when a patient comes in, let's say if they have pancreatic cancer or they have lung cancer or they have breast cancer, it turns out when people have these specific kind of cancers, that doctors begin to realize that there's a lot of coherence between the lives of the people with this type of cancer different from the lives of people with this type of cancer. So it turned out the cancers are not random. They're really related, you know, as a reflection of the stresses and anger that the individual is facing in their lives. So where they get the cancer is as diagnostic as to the source of their problem, but the cancer is the symptom. The problem is you're not paying attention.
No, you've got to read down into what the energy is doing.
That's exactly what it's all about. Okay. And the interesting thing, so where do these energies and where do they come from? Well, that part, when I started to realize that, is, well, they come from the environment. But then you say, well, what is the environment? And then it comes, now here's the thing is, the environment is anything from the core of your existence to the edge of the universe. And that means any energies
in
there.
One
environment.
That's one environment, and we are all one being in that way. That's what Buddha discovered, actually.
Well, and this is why all this is really great, because when I started to do this, I started to realize, my God, this new science connects everything from ancient history. And things like astrology. Astrology becomes astrophysiology. We're reading vibrational frequency resonances. And it's interesting because the sun is the primary source of the broadcast, and the planets are magnets. And they distort the beam as they move around the sun and focus the energy or defocus the energy, and we're responding to these energies. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, astrology comes into play. Feng shui. Yes, everything is energy. Everything that's made out of matter is also broadcasting energy. So the reality is, when I started to go into the quantum physics nature, the holism was overwhelming to me. I mean, it's like, everything is connected to everything else. And when you understand this, all these little pieces of ancient knowledge that have come through time, you know, the Asian form of healing with energies, meridians and chakras, that's part of the system as well.
Acupuncture,
astrology, feng shui, homeopathy, and all these
where
things.
Where there's not even a molecule of the original substance left
in
the water.
No, the vibrational frequency is left.
Uh-huh.
And the cells respond to the frequency, not the molecules. And this is why it's so important, because the pharmaceutical industry knows this, but suppresses this knowledge for the reason is this. I'll give you a simple reason. I'll give you an analogy.
You think it's really deliberate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let me give you, I'll ask you a question. in your awareness or whatever you think, you know, what you've come across, are there other ways to provide energy for this planet besides the use of fossil fuel that are probably more efficient and healthier for us? Yes or no?
Oh, absolutely.
Then how come we're not using them?
Oh, I see.
Why
it's,
not?
It's the money.
Yeah, by who's controlling it?
Well, the current administration.
Yeah, the fossil fuel industry.
Right.
Right, because they're selling oil. What the heck do they want to give you free energy for? They make money selling you oil.
Nikola Tesla was dancing with this.
That's right, and he got pushed out. Why? Yep. Because it was not in the interest to give away this energy.
Not in the local interest, but in the interest of the collective. Yes.
Yeah. Now take a look this way. What's the biggest industry on this planet? It's not the fossil fuel industry. It's the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh.
They sell chemical drugs.
Yeah. Which now, in some cases are marvelously effective.
Yeah, unfortunately the cases and the numbers of that are very insignificant in regard to the total amount of drug usage that's going on in this planet, pharmaceutical drug usage.
Oh, in a percentage, yeah. But there is some legitimate.
Oh, I'm not saying there isn't. I mean there's also a reason for fossil fuel, but there's also other uses for fossil fuel as well, okay?
Right.
But here's
the
point.
Yep.
The pharmaceutical industry sells chemicals. They're not interested in energy healing. So the money that goes into research is not going to go into, let's see if we could find out how I can heal with an energy vibration. That's the last thing they want to have. Why?
Well, the allopaths have been trying to discount the chiropractors for
forever.
Years.
And yet the reality is, and this is why I ended up, migrating into the chiropractic community, because it was interesting because I didn't realize what chiropractic was. And when I started to give lectures on this new biology, which incorporated the quantum physics and the environmental influences.
And there's network chiropractic particularly.
That's another version of it that essentially emphasizes the vibrational energy in the field.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And when I started to realize it, and I was asked to give a philosophy talk for chiropractors, and I said, look, I'm an allopath teacher. I don't know anything from this chiropractic. And they said, you're talking chiropractic with your new biology. So it was interesting. I got a hold of D.D. Palmer, the founder of chiropractic. I got a hold of his original book, started to read it.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, my God, this guy was talking about vibration and tone and perception and everything. It was like, it was exactly what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it's real interesting. Yet, unfortunately, chiropractic, wanting to become more scientifically based, has made a concerted effort to remove its own fundamental philosophy, which was on energy and perception.
And move toward the allopaths.
And they become less effective, and they do that.
So
what's real interesting is that this is a time for us to reconsider who we are, reconsider how our beliefs are really involved in this entire process, and start to recognize that we are more powerful than anybody wanted to let on. And I really think that's another concerted effort to keep us disempowered. And the reason why...
And there are people who have recognized that, such as Gandhi and Martin Luther King, in recent time.
Yeah. Yep. And simply the reason is that in the planet, the way we created our social hierarchy, it's a hierarchy of power. That there are very powerful people at the top and less powerful people at the bottom. And yet what I started to realize, and this is like one of those aha moments in my life, was I started to realize this was like, we're all creatively equally powerful people. As Jesus was trying to say, anybody can do what I'm doing.
Buddha too, yeah.
Okay,
we
could all do this. Mm-hmm. So the way it says, well, we're all equally powerful, then how can you have a society where there are more powerful people and less powerful people? And you might think, some people got more power. And I said, no, we all have an equal amount of power. You can't get more. Then you take away the power from others.
But how is that taken away? The other has to allow you to take it.
Because it's been perpetrated through teaching the teaching of perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unfortunate. Back in the days of the Church of Rome, they were the education system.
Mm-hmm.
Their knowledge was infallible knowledge. This is the way it is. This is what you learn, what I teach you. You don't want to go to this school, then I kill you. And basically, what did they do? They put people in a box with the information that they programmed them with, and then people live with that. I mean, the Jesuits would be very proud. They would say, you give us a child until it's six or seven, and will belong to the church for the rest of its life. What they really meant and what they knew was the first six or so years of a child's life is total programming of perceptions. The rest of the life is living with those perceptions.
Mm-hmm. So now we come to the thing that I have a great deal of fascination with about effecting change through the dance of the unconscious and the conscious mind. And I think it's really interesting. I listened to your interview on New Dimensions, and you were talking to Michael Toms about that our conscious mind has, what is it, 40 parts of attention, and we're working with our unconscious mind that has 40 million.
40 million, yeah. It's interesting because for me it was a big surprise to identify the existence of the two minds. We read about it, we talk about it, but I didn't have a personal experience with it until the first time I went to a chiropractor after I had a real serious motorcycle accident.
Mm-hmm.
And my medical colleague said, here's some pills. That muscle relaxant, that didn't help. I was real trouble skeleton-wise. And one of my students was a chiropractor, so it was suggested I see the student in his dorm room. He could do an adjustment. So I went there, and being very naive and being in a system where we always look down at chiropractors as quacks, I was sort of like the guy who said, well, show me something, you know, because I have no belief here.
Right.
So he said, well, let me show you something. Let me show you kinesiology, muscle testing.
Right.
So basically, that, you know, I hold out my arm, and he says, say your name is Bruce, and then he says, resist, as he pushes down, and I can hold my arm real strong, and he can't push it. And then he says, say your name is Carol, and then hold your arm strong. And I'm thinking in my head, well, this is the stupidest thing I ever heard. I can keep my arm as strong. I don't care what words I say. So I hold out my arm, and I say, my name is Carol. And all of a sudden, he pushed my arm, and I could feel this weakness. And I said, and it's interesting, because I think almost everyone, the first time they experienced that, I said the same thing. It was sort of, well, wait, I wasn't ready. Let's do it
right,
again.
Let's do it again. Right.
So this time now, I'm really making a conscious effort thinking, of course I can hold my hand up. Yeah. And I say my name is Carol, my arm dropped, and then it hit me like a ton of bricks. I said, oh my God, I'm not controlling my arm. If I was controlling it, I would have been able to hold it strong. Something else is controlling my arm at this moment besides my conscious mind. And then I realized, well, of course it's my subconscious mind. But then the big kicker, there was like, not only was the subconscious mind controlling it, it was more powerful than my conscious mind, because my conscious mind couldn't override that and keep my arm strong.
Right.
So then all of a sudden the big, eye in the sky opens up, and I realize how much of my life is coming from the subconscious program versus how much is coming from the conscious program. And more importantly, does the subconscious program have programs that disagree with my conscious programs? Why? Because if it does, it will supersede, and its programs will win because it's stronger.
Yep.
Okay, so down the line, what do I come to find out? As we mentioned, the subconscious mind is, in fact, a million times more powerful a processor of information than is the conscious mind.
And where did you get that information?
Well, this is from a book by Noren Trenders. It's cited in the references.